Welcome to From the Booth, the podcast hosted by the International Cinema Program at BYU. I'm Chip Oskerson. I'm here with co-host Mark Yamada.
Great to be here.
We're the co-directors of International Cinema, and we're here to talk about the last full week of International Cinema winter 2019 semester, and to give a quick preview of what will be coming up at International Cinema this fall when we resume our programming. This semester is quite a semester. We showed what I think is a record 53 films. The oldest film was Three Penny Opera from 1931. The newest films, there were 17 of our films that were released in 2018. So we're tending very much towards the contemporary. Yeah. And this is deliberate, that these are the films that are harder for students and faculty to be able to see anywhere else. These are usually not on streaming services. Kind of gives us a good sense of what's going on in film today. So this is a positive development. 22 languages were represented by my count. Danish, English, Japanese, Arabic, Spanish, Korean, Portuguese, Mandarin, Russian, German, French, Georgian, Greek, Basque, Kurdish, Polish, Estonian, Dari, Swedish, Thai, Burmese, and Hindi.
Wow.
To name all of them. So it was, we had pretty good representation that way. We had several series, Creativity and Disability, Oppression and Self-Expression, Opera on Film, Global Animation, Routes and Roots, or Roots and Roots, depending on your pronunciation, Man Against the Machine, Bertolt Brecht in film. We celebrated some of his contributions to film. And then Los Reyes Mexicanos de Hollywood, where we were looking at Cuarón, Iñárritu, and Del Toro and some of their work. So it was quite a semester. It was a lot of films, a lot of great films.
Yeah.
Mark, you've been teaching the International Cinema class this semester. What stood out to the students from all of these things? What was the buzz at the end of the class?
Yeah, so by the way, International Cinema class, just a little plug. It's a great way to get some credit, right? And also see a lot of films and have a little bit of explanation and time for discussion. But this semester, we had our last class last Wednesday, and I gave them an informal questionnaire about their favorite films or the films that kind of stood out to them. And four categories that we had: thought-provoking films, entertaining films, films that are, you know, leave your worldview at the door, films that really kind of shook you, changed the way that you saw the world, and then technical films. Some of the ones that stood out for these categories, The Guilty, On Her Shoulders, Lion, Transit, First Reform, were the ones that really stood out for the thought-provoking, the ones that really kind of made students think, right?
Yeah, and interestingly that some of these are formally quite interesting films, right? So they kind of defy genre expectations.
In
terms of technique, it defies expectations, so that's interesting.
Right. And the most entertaining films, Ramen Shop, which was a Japanese film that we showed, Bad Genius, a Thai film we'll be talking about today, Borg versus McEnroe, some of the films that students, you know, felt entertained with. Mirai was the anime choice for that. Films that really shook the students' worldview, made them see the world in a different way after they saw the film. First Reformed,
this is one of my favorites from the semester, I think.
The great English language film that we showed from 2018, I believe.
Yeah.
And then Mother, the Korean kind of detective mystery style.
Comedy, tragedy, noir. I don't know what that was.
Actually. Yeah, I mean, it was really in some ways shocking for students. And then I think
the reason it comes across as shocking is that it's about a crime,
right?
But there are these comedic elements to it, right? I mean, it's like
you don't always know what to do with it. Yeah, and it goes against your expectations. And Korean cinema, you don't really have any bearings, especially if you're coming new to it. You don't really know the genre conventions and things like that. So it really kind of shakes you a little bit.
Sure.
Farewell, My Concubine was another one that students had a really strong reaction to and played with their sense of cultures and even gender identity and things like that. So
there's so many things going on in that film, and it's difficult to know how is this pushing the envelope even for Chinese viewers how much of this is simply a culture I don't understand, right?
That's right.
We had a good, the lecture by Dr. Francesca Lawson was really good in helping me to process
get a
some
sense
of that
of
and understand
where
this was coming from about Peking opera.
For sure.
Yeah.
And then finally, the films that the students thought were most technically interesting, I mean, in terms of, you know, obviously editing and cinematography, things like that, Children of Men was up there.
Also Cuarón film.
Cuarón film.
Yeah, those long takes are really stunning. They really make that film in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Shape of Water. Cleo, the French film that we showed, that was this real time.
Yeah, the Agnès Varda film.
Yeah, that was really good too.
I was glad we showed that, especially since she passed away during the semester.
Good timing is maybe not the best way to put it, but
that's right. But it was a good tribute to her.
Yeah. And so it was a really great class, and we invite all those who are interested in taking the IC class to register for fall 2019.
Yeah, ICS, it's under ICS 290R. You can take it as many times as you want because the films are always changing.
Yeah,
right?
It's a different class every semester.
Different class every semester. So that's great. Well, it's interesting to hear. I like having the class too because it's a good focus group.
Right.
Always with these films right. to find out, you know, how are they playing? How are people reacting to them? And so I think that's interesting to get that feedback. Well, let's talk about the last regular week of the semester, that is April 10th to 13th. Just a reminder for those listening that we're going to be discussing the films, assuming that you've already seen them, so you can use the time codes provided to skip any spoilers in the conversation. The films for this week were Match Made by God, the 2008 musical comedy by Aditya Chopra, starring the king of Bollywood, Shah Rukh Khan. We had Bad Genius, a Thai film directed by Natawut Poonpiriya, from 2017, kind of a thriller, appropriately timed at the end of the semester with finals. We'll talk about that. Then our documentary for the week was Burma Storybook. This is a documentary by Peter Lohm, a Czech filmmaker working out of the Netherlands, about a country emerging from dictatorship, told through the nation's poetry, a very poetic film itself. And then lastly, Giant, a Basque film from 2017 by directors Jan Garjano and Aitor Aregi. A groundbreaking film insofar that it's a Basque language film. It's not the first Basque language film, but certainly the most successful one to date. So let's start with the film that I think excited me the most for the week, which is A Match Made by God. This is, of course, a Bollywood film. Bollywood is a huge film industry and a mature film industry. We got a representation from Nigeria's film industry, Nollywood, earlier in the semester. I guess that didn't make my list of languages. It was technically English,
right.
But there were a lot of other languages in that too. And what you see going into Nollywood is it's an emerging film industry. Mm-hmm. And the technical sophistication is not what we're used to seeing from Bollywood. Bollywood is there, right? I mean, they really have refined technique. And that's one of the things that strikes me about a lot of these big blockbuster Bollywood films is that these people really know the craft well and are able to put together, from a technical standpoint, a really interesting film. Also interesting in the length. You know, what Bollywood film isn't less than definitely 2 hours, maybe 3 hours
long. And this one was supposedly on the short end, right?
Yeah, right, with a playing time of 167 minutes. But there's a different expectation. Is, you know, when you go to a movie, what are you getting? You know, if you're not getting an intermission, why are you going, right? This film is known, it's been one of the most successful films in Bollywood, certainly in the year that it was made. It's referred to as RNBDJ, which doesn't exactly roll off the tongue.
No.
But this is coming from the original language, Rab Nibbana Di Jodi, but RNBDJ. It stars, as I mentioned earlier, Shah Rukh Khan. He is referred to as the Badshah of Bollywood. In other words, the King of Bollywood, or King Khan, as he's sometimes referred to. He's been in over 80 Bollywood films, and I think it's significant that, of course, he stars in this film, insofar that it's a parody of precisely the kinds of films he makes. Right? Maybe not a parody. Well, no, I think you can say a parody. I mean, it's very meta-cinematic in that it's very self-aware of the persona that he usually plays.
And you catch some of that, but there must be these layers of self-awareness that if you're not really fully aware of the genre, that you're kind of missing as you watch this film.
No, I think so. That I'm sure, I'm sure that's the case. I'm missing a lot. He's starring over and against Anushka Sharma. This is her first film. And there was a big deal made about a talent search to find this. She's only 19 years old, which surprised me. She does a really great job in this.
Yeah.
Khan plays this mild-mannered, somewhat boring, nerdish office worker named Surinder Sani, who falls in love with this beautiful, vivacious, and vibrant Tani. And they, out of devotion to her dying father, she marries him, even though it's not a marriage that is born out of love. And very quickly she becomes unhappy because he's very predictable and dependable, but not really appealing to her fun-loving nature.
Right.
And so he has to find a way to win her love. So he transforms himself into this character, somewhat inadvertently, Raj, and becomes her dancing partner. And she doesn't recognize him in his transformed state. So he's playing this double role. And Raj, unlike his normal character, is very outgoing, is brash and a little bit macho. And, you know, some of these things that we associate actually with this this Bollywood star persona. She loves the films, and so she's very taken by this. She loves dancing. So the way that the entire film plays out is, who is she choosing, you know, Raj or Surinder? Of course, they're the same person. So yeah. you get around some of the problems that might have arisen with a censor in India, and that she's technically not being unfaithful to her. not that there's anything untoward going on between the two of them. But her flirtations with Raj are, of course, her husband. She just doesn't happen to know that at the time.
And she doesn't really like Raj at first, right? I mean,
she's put off by
kind of his brashness, right? A little bit, yeah.
But it's kind of won over by him eventually. Yeah. Great music, great dancing. This was the first Bollywood soundtrack to hit iTunes top 10, apparently. and it really is compelling music. I mentioned a little bit the technique. I was really taken by the interesting camera work in this, in this film, how often the camera is joining together two spaces in the film. So when she marries him, he recognizes that this is going to take time for her to warm up, so he moves into the attic upstairs, and there are these interesting shots where the camera will, in a single shot, go from the attic to downstairs where she is in, you know, in the bedroom, and the kind of the contrast of these spaces. This happens again in a dressing room scene where you get this wall between them where they're in a store and they have this conversation across the wall. And it was interesting, I thought, how the camera joined spaces in these kinds of ways, made a lot of really creative use of the camera. The color palette was really interesting too. Primary colors, you know, really strong, really bold colors that you begin to associate with these characters, and really, really well done. The theme to me that really stood out was this tension between fate versus agency. And what seems to be underlying this is different expectations about what marriage and relationships are. And of course, this is a culture where you still have arranged marriages are still a very common thing. And so the expectations you have going into an arranged marriage or a marriage that you're entering into because of familial expectations is very different than one that's grounded in love, And so it seems to be wanting to probe this a little bit about what can you expect when on one the other. Now, it's trying to have it both ways, It's an arranged marriage that becomes one of spontaneous romantic, you know, kind of love that's only brought about by the fact that she's given the opportunity to choose, in essence, in the movie. And I thought that was kind of an interesting...
It's back and forth. I mean, she honors her father and his dying wish, So that honor's there from the start, and then she has this flirtation and expresses her own interests and desires and things like that. But it seems like that's all within this honorable expression, that she has. I mean, it's interesting how, in some ways, the languages of love that you see here, where her devotion to her husband, even though she is kind of going off and dancing, is shown through kind of food, She makes food for him. She packs his lunch, which is, an expression, of devotion and love in that way. And so, interesting way in which that's negotiated.
I think that's exactly right. The film comes to the position that love is seeing God in somebody else. I thought that it was interesting. There are some interesting things going on with gender that are laid on all of this, And all of it's being mediated by film. You know, they're going to films, they're watching films. He's playing this character, that he's playing is a character from a film that he's, you know, basically seen or in a, you know, kind of combination.
And they're referencing American films, Singing in the Rain. I mean, there's this intertextual thing going on.
Yeah, it's very, very kind of aware of the way that media plays certain roles and things like that. But the gender roles that were really interesting. So at the same time that you have a woman who it's trying to create this space for her to choose her destiny and fate within something that's kind of been chosen for her. There are a couple of these montage dance scenes, you know, where they're like visiting temples and dancing around. And it was interesting how often she's portrayed, despite the fact that she's this kind of strong, independent woman, the thing that it comes back to a lot of times is her piety, her devotion in the temples, doing the rituals that she needs to be doing, dressed in the appropriate way. And I thought that there was some disjunction sometimes going on. It wanted to have its cake and eat it too constantly.
Because that provides, in some ways, the counterbalance of these dance halls and these modern contemporary styles and dresses and speaking more English and being hip, And then you have this kind of sacred counterbalance of that, If there's a balance in that, it seems like it's okay, And it was an attempt to kind of keep that balance.
And there's a correlative on the side of the men as well, I should hasten to say. This is not just dealing with these competing portrayals of women, but the men as well, right? So on the one hand, Surrender, who's doing his duty for his family, he's very dependable, kind of works hard, does a good job at what he does. But then Raj at the same time, who's very macho and out there. And it really wants to critique that macho-ness, actually. This actually turns her off. It's the least appealing part of his persona that he takes on.
Right.
And it has to be tempered in all these ways. And yet that role that he's playing is what I think is constantly being shown through films, right? That this is what the ideal man actually is. Mm. And we're dealing with a culture that's still, like a lot of cultures in the world, trying to understand particularly what to do about violence against women, that there was this really horrible case that really shocked India just a few years ago of, it was a gang rape on a bus. The details are really quite sordid and horrible. And it really shocked the nation in a lot of respects because it was a very public, you know, sort of thing. What are the attitudes that we have that we portray in our culture that when they're actually played out are quite unpalatable, that this isn't what we actually stand for as a culture? You know, that's kind of all swirling around here. So I found this interesting. And then I want to get your take on one additional thing. There's a scene towards the end where they go to I think it's a trade show exhibition, and it's like Japanese themed.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And in fact, all the credits run where they're on this vacation to Japan.
Right.
And there's this really strange orientalization, in Bollywood cinema of Japan.
Yeah, and it's not even just Japan. It seems like this kind of pan-Asian representation, right? Which is something that's... You know,
everything east of here.
Right. And, you know, and you have these kind of sumo wrestlers that are there, and he has to actually fight a sumo wrestler, right? And
it's not a particularly well-motivated plot point.
No. And it might play into this idea of kind of masculine. I mean, in some ways, it's him against this guy, and he's having to prove his physical... And she seems really unimpressed by all this, right? That she's kind of watching him get beat up a little bit here, but to me it seemed like a little bit of a way of delaying the ending. But it is interesting how there is this appropriation of culture, this free appropriation that's going on, even of American culture. I mean, this kind of playfulness that you're appropriating it, but you're not doing it in this exact precise way, but you're kind of bringing in the kind of the fantasy of it. This is how kind of Indian people might see Asia and Japan and the things that stick out, sumo wrestling. And, you know, in some ways in our country, in America, we're kind of moving more towards this respecting of kind of cultural, you know, details and things like that. But you see this a little bit more of an open kind of playful appropriation of culture is going on here, American culture. I mean, no culture is really, you know, exempt from this. And you'd think that in Asia, there would be this kind of idea of, you know, Asian, not really appropriating Asian culture, but this kind of more East-West. But within this kind of Eastern Asian cultural sphere, you see the differences that, you know, it's not just kind of one Asia, but there's several different kind of Asias, and how they interact with each other is interesting.
Yeah, no, something that you just don't see all that much.
Yeah.
Well, let's turn our attention then to the second film from this week, which is Bad Genius. This is another kind of geared a little bit more towards a popular audience, I would say.
Yeah.
Definitely a thriller in all kinds of ways. There's more Deadline narratives in this than one can shake a stick.
There was a couple of students who said, I couldn't go to the bathroom because I couldn't. I didn't know when I could. It was too relentless. Yeah, this is an interesting film. It was apparently the most internationally successful Thai film ever.
Really?
Yeah, really popular in Hong Kong, Taiwan, Southeast Asia, even Northeast Asia, in China and Japan, had a really big box office showing there.
It's about a cheating scam.
It's about a cheating, ring in a Thai high school. And there's obvious kind of connections to this Asian preoccupation with exams and entrance exams and kind of this whole school culture, which is really a theme in a lot of culture in Asia. And so that's probably kind of one of the reasons why it was so popular. And you have this heist, you know, international heist theme and, you know, this kind of really thriller style, which I think was really drew audiences in. Something that I thought was interesting about this film, and another thing, this idea of how nations represent themselves through film, because this is, you know, ostensibly one of the most popular Thai films ever, and one that people see. It's on Netflix now, I think, and so films that people are really kind of, they're going to Thailand and Thai culture through this film, but it's not really a film that you really want to maybe represent your culture through, right? This idea of cheating and kind of this morally ambiguous issue. And I think one of the reasons is that it's really, in some ways, I think, designed as more of a critique of Thai culture, of Thailand, of economic development, maybe even Southeast Asia. This will maybe connect to Burma's storybook a little bit, but this maybe kind of hasty sense of development that's going on. I was in Thailand actually a year or two ago, and something I really noticed is this kind of haphazard sense of development that you're getting in Thailand and in Southeast Asia. On the one hand, you have this first world kind of luxury hotels, especially in kind of the seaside locales we usually associate with, you know, these pristine beaches, right, of Thailand. You go there and you'll have just tons of hotels, of Hiltons, and the all the big names, right, all the big global companies. And yet these hotels, you'll have these third world problems. You'll have problems with sewage, you know, electricity, the power will go down regularly. And I was talking with somebody who was there, and I was trying to figure out this discrepancy between this first world opulence on the one hand, and yet this third world problems that you have. And he was mentioning the fact that 30 or 40 years ago, you had this huge kind of rush of capital, of money kind of coming in, development, places like Phuket, which is the seaside area, right, that we usually associate with, you know, the beautiful beaches of Thailand. They just developed so many hotels and, you know, right next to each other. I mean, the big hotels. The problem was, as he was mentioning, is that they built these hotels on top of this third world infrastructure.
Yeah.
And so you have all this power demand, you know, sewage demand, all this new demand on top of this, you know, this infrastructure that really can't support this.
Yeah.
And it led to all kinds of problems. And I think in some ways that's going on in the film here is that you see this critique of, in the film, you have two students who are trying to do things the right way. I mean, they're lower on the kind of socioeconomic rung. And you have a high school where you have really rich kids and you have kind of kids who are kind of lower. The lower end kids have intelligence and they have brains and they have, you know, the studying discipline. And so they do well in school and they're brought into this. First, it's a kind of a tutoring ring with the kind of the richer students, and then it turns into kind of this cheating thing. But it shows how in some ways they're skipping these steps instead of developing in this way of kind of social mobility of starting from the bottom and developing through hard work and using, you know, your resources to just make that jump into taking the easy money.
Or maybe a frustration that there's not equal opportunity, right? That it's there's not equal a meritocracy. Opportunity. Really, it comes down to...
It really comes down to money.
To money. And so if that's the game, you know, is that what
you
have
gotta
to
play,
right?
Yeah. And the one tragic character, I mean, the main protagonist is a woman and she's, you know, really bright, but her friend is kind of a poorer student and wins a scholarship and is, you know, number one in his class. And he gets kind of tricked into this whole thing. He doesn't really actually choose it himself. He actually kind of gets manipulated into being a part of it. And then once he's in it, he realizes this is really the only thing he can do. And this is really the only way to kind of succeed in this culture is to be shady and to create, you know, this criminal activity. And so I think it is this kind of critique of the way in which Thailand often and some of maybe these kind of developing nations will allow development to run amok, right?
Yeah.
To kind of take the easy capital and to not really build that infrastructure bottom up rather than kind of a,
Well, and two, the big test that they're cheating on at the end is the exam you need to take to get into American universities.
Right.
You know, that this becomes a sort of interesting symbol, I think, for this is when you've arrived.
Right.
And again, I think you could pick at that those assumptions, like why is that the gold standard, right? You know, why is that the thing that everyone's shooting
for? It seems like everything's a commodity. Even the students who have this talent to taking tests becomes this commodity that the rich people can use in order to get into these universities, which are in some ways, you know, considered to be a commodity as well. Like if you have this, you know, if you went to even any American university, Boston University, I think is the one that they mentioned.
Yeah.
If you have that on your resume and you go back to Thailand, you have this clout, right? And so I think it's a critique of that, of turning everything into this commodity. I mean, the students themselves, the ones who are involved in this cheating ring, become a commodity, right?
Right.
And really this cynical look at test taking, right?
Yeah.
They can kind of pull off this.
Well, you know, this is the moment we're in the United States as well, right? That we,
yeah.
you know, just endured this, you know, hearing about this scandal where there was a similar you know, kind of thing going on. You know, the rich and the powerful paying to get their kids into, you know, to the schools they wanted them in.
Yeah.
And people being willing to take the money.
Right. I mean, it becomes kind of a game.
Yeah.
But interesting kind of critique of development in Southeast Asia, which in some ways might relate a little bit to Burma Storybook.
Yeah, I found
film.
Burma Storybook to be you know, very interesting. I mean, it's very poetic. There's not a single narrative that's going on here that we're being told about the state of this interesting country that is emerging out of dictatorship and a long kind of civil strife. I mean, hopefully emerging. I guess we could we could debate whether they're really emerging or not. But undergoing the kind of pains that come. I mean, on the one hand, these have been some very positive steps. but there's a lot of hardships that the people are suffering. One of the biggest that the film focuses on is the unwillingness of the previous regime, which is still really in power, to acknowledge what's happened and to come to terms with that. And that's a real problem. I mean, even acknowledging the sheer number of political prisoners and the people that suffered this kind of real trauma. And so they're not given many resources to work through that at all. Poetry becomes one of these resources. And there is an interesting comment by one of the poet's former prisoners, you know, talks about that one of the things they could do in prison was write poetry. Yeah. And they wrote a lot of poetry and shared their poetry. And that this is presented in the film as a really important part of Burmese culture. I mean, it's interesting because we don't, in our school systems today here in the United States, we don't memorize poetry, like very, very seldomly. I think that's used to be done more. And the Burmese culture is, of course, it is a written culture, but there's more of an oral aspect to it. I got the impression that people are reciting these poems from memory and songs and things like that. And there's something that's lost when it makes me think of a poem, actually, by the Swedish poet Tomas Tranströmer, where he's talking about in Western culture, we write things down so that we can forget them, we're not forced to kind of keep them with us. And I thought that this was a really, you know, powerful film in showing kind of living poetry. And it does that not only by hearing the people recite it, but these really poetic images of everyday life going on in Myanmar and what life is like for very average, you know, people.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. It's Burma storybook, right? So there's a sense of kind of what nostalgia for the past here. Yeah. I mean, in Myanmar now, but it's interesting that it's referred to here as Burma, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I think you're right about that. I think that it's intentionally evoking some of that. And these will be, you know, films that I think this film will age well, right? Some documentaries, because they're very didactic, you know, they want to highlight a problem that's very actual right now. This seems to transcend that just a little bit. I mean, there are some very specific problems that Burma's dealing with, of course, but that's not primarily what the focus of the film is, that there's this specific problem that needs these kinds of solutions, but trying to highlight more the spirit of a people, I think, at a particular time. And like I said, I think it's very artfully done. And these filmmakers who did it have done some really interesting work around the world in Iran and other places that are similar kinds of things, trying to put their finger on the pulse of what's going on in a country and in difficult countries too, you know, not countries that you know, it's smooth sailing, but ones that are going through quite tumultuous times.
It's interesting how you see there's different patterns of development. Even in Asia, I mean, you have with Burma, with Myanmar, you have this kind of authoritarian style of development, at least until, I mean, it still is largely, I mean, it's become democratic in the last, 10 or 20 years, but in some ways following South Korea and the way in which there was kind of this authoritarian regime for a long time. And even in Thailand as well, there's a little bit more of this kind of authoritarianism. So ways in which democracy isn't necessarily the path towards modernization. Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of these cultures have embraced democracy recently, right? Or at least kind of made strides towards.
But it comes with a price.
Yeah.
You know, it definitely does. It's a difficult transition. And especially with how do you deal with the authoritarian past and the violence that was perpetrated on, you know, on the people.
Right.
No, absolutely. Maybe that's a good segue, too, to the final film that we're talking about this week, Giant. The Basque people, of course, have been a repressed minority in a lot of ways. It's been a very violent kind of relationship with the cultures around it. But a culture that's been able to maintain a lot of its identity. That Basque, of course, is a language that's not an Indo-European language even.
Yeah.
So
it's kind of its own thing.
It's kind of its own thing. And this film stands out as one of the few Basque language films.
Right. And in some ways, this is represented through the protagonist who stands out, right?
That's exactly right, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's The Giant from 2017, it really kind of follows the story of two brothers, one sent to fight in, I think it's the Spanish Civil War, mid-19th century, comes back home in Basque country to find that his brother has become a giant. I mean, he has...
Yeah, suffers from giantism.
Giantism,
and
right?
And this is an actual historical...
Right.
It's based on...
Based on a historical person. He has this growth disorder, and that... There's a little bit of a maybe attempt of the older brother to kind of use this as a commercial purpose to gain as maybe kind of a, you know, a traveling curiosity, right? And there's some kind of exchange with doctors. And all the while you get a sense of this almost dismissal of Basque culture and the Basque people as kind of being what, peasants and not necessarily kind of accepted.
Or being freakish, maybe.
Being
in,
freakish
in a way,
in a sense,
kind of
yeah.
The larger context of European cultures.
So, in some ways,
an oddity.
an oddity, right, is kind of the idea there. So, you're getting a little bit of this idea of how Basque country, which is, I guess, in some ways, it's northern Spain and western France, mm-hmm. southwestern France area, mm-hmm. this kind of area unto itself. Has kind of stood out, right? It hasn't really fit in. Historically been repressed culturally, linguistically, right, by both the Spanish and the French side. Now I think it's become more independent, right, the Basque country, mm-hmm. and there's a little bit more of a political kind of independence they enjoy. But traditionally there's that sense of not really fitting in, right? And I think even with the Spanish Civil War of not really fighting on the right side, not really fitting in on one side or the other is how I think you get this sense. And I think in Giant, you really get that idea through the main character who doesn't really fit into either any culture that he goes to, right? He kind of travels around Europe and kind of stands out wherever he goes. And so interesting look at that and kind of national identity.
Yeah, well, and the problems with cultural appropriation too, right? I mean, that he's made a freak in a kind of a freak show kind of thing. And that's not, sometimes we maybe delude ourselves into thinking that, you know, by highlighting cultural difference that we're celebrating it somehow, but sometimes what we're doing is kind of orientalization that we were talking about before going on in the Bollywood film, that we're making kind of a mockery or parody of it by pointing out its differences, that this, you know, it has to be handled, you know, sensitively. I think it's significant that this is coming from a Basque filmmaker, right? I think that is always an interesting step in a culture's kind of broader acceptance or kind of participation within more global discourses when they can begin to articulate themselves as opposed to being articulated entirely by others. And I don't know that we're going to see a large Basque film industry kind of emerge out of this. There's a lot of forces that are still trying to kind of contain Basqueness because it threatens a certain idea of what Spain is. But I do think that it's always a healthy thing, right? To allow cultures to express themselves.
And that's why it's so interesting that Bad News chose, or I guess it didn't really necessarily, Thailand didn't necessarily choose this film to represent it, but it's become kind of the representation, at least in the last, 5 or 10 years, of Thai culture. And so how are you being represented? How are you representing yourself kind of on a global stage? And then Giant, as a little bit more of the sense of kind of expression of national identity. Yomedin, a film that we showed this semester, Egyptian film, is another interesting film that's really kind of come to represent maybe modern Egypt, right? And this push against or move away from kind of the traditional stereotypical way of looking at Egypt and looking at some of the problems of contemporary Egypt. And so interesting way in which nations represent themselves through film.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this is one of the great things about international cinema, right, is that you get this opportunity to hear people's express themselves in their own way, in their own language, and meet them on their own terms. Well, that was winter 2019. That kind of sums it up. Let's just take a couple minutes before the end of our podcast here to talk about what's going to be coming up. Our schedule is not set in stone yet. We're still previewing films and getting ready for what will be coming. But we've identified a few themes that we're trying to build around. One of these is a series on international noir. And the idea behind this is that we wanted to have a nice historical scope, show some classic noirs, kind of showing the beginning of film noir in Europe, expressionist sorts of things from the kind of 20s or 30s particularly. We'd like to bring Fritz Lang's classic M to the screen. This is something that students still respond well to, a 1931 film that really resonates, I think, in a lot of ways today. Lang, of course, himself needs to flee the Nazis in the 30s. He comes to Hollywood, and he brings with him, and he's not the only one. There's several that bring this style that they've been playing with in Europe, and this is what classic noir becomes in Hollywood in the 1940s, a lot of moral ambiguity that I think came with the war and with the kinds of issues, social issues that were being faced at the time. And, becomes an important film genre. I think we can talk about it as most appropriately as a kind of a genre. I mean, it really flourishes in Hollywood and then gets re-exported, you know, back out to the rest of the world in this interesting kind of way. And so the series would ideally kind of capture some of this. There's been a new release of the French film Panique from the 50s that, you know, very much shows the influence of kind of noir having moved through Hollywood as it's kind of re-exported back to France. There's a lot of great contemporary examples. A couple Arabic language films. There's a Nordic noir has established itself with the Wallander films and series, both in fiction and in film. So we're going to see what we can pull together with some of this. Should be kind of interesting. Another series has to do with race.
Yeah, so we have we're planning a week on looking at some recent films that deal with African-American culture in America in particular, a few films that stood out in the Oscar race this past year. Green Book obviously won the Oscar, and Beale Street is another film that, If Beale Street Could Talk,
yeah, an adaptation of James Baldwin.
Right, is another one that we're looking at bringing in. And
Barry Jenkins.
Right.
Yeah, he's a standout filmmaker right now.
So those are that's one series we're looking at. We're also looking at doing something with Chinese culture and Chinese diaspora and thinking about maybe Chinese identity that transcends just mainland China. We're looking at Southeast Asia and then American mainland Chinese or American Chinese kind of cultural identity. And so there's been a few films that have come out recently that have dealt with this issue. Crazy Rich Asians is one in particular that deals with different forms of Chinese kind of cultural identity and also kind of this nouveau rich kind of culture.
And interesting, too, for, you know, a different kind of representation of Asian Americans than we've seen historically. Right,
right. Right. So kind of broadening our view of that a little bit. And then a film that premiered at Sundance this past January, The Farewell. An interesting film about Chinese, an American woman played by Awkwafina, who goes from America to China and has a little bit of a kind of a cultural gap, right, between her expectations and how she acts and what's expected of her and different kind of rituals and expectations that go along with the whole premise is that her grandmother may be dying and they're going to go there and kind of spend time with her and how she's expected to act and how she acts as kind of this American Chinese woman and how her relatives act in a different way. And so interesting film that way.
Yeah. Yeah. One other series that we're thinking of has to do with borders and walls, picking up on the Kennedy Center's theme for fall semester. And two films that I'm excited to bring in this connection, documentaries both. One is about Gaza, the Gaza Strip, and it's a very beautifully shot film about what is everyday life like for people who live in Gaza. And really raises the question of, can there ever be justice when there's fundamental inequity in power, in regards to power and access to power? The other film that I'm really excited about is called Midnight Traveler, and it's about a family kind of shot in real time on cell phones. And I mean, the quality is better than what it sounds like. These are actually filmmakers, but they were an Afghani filmmaker who was forced to leave Afghanistan, and he and his family are making their way to Europe, and they're filming. Like I said, it's all shot in kind of real time, and they're sending these SIM chips to a friend in the United States who was his editor, who was clipping all of this together. Really powerful film about migration and about, you know, what these people go through to, you know, why they choose to leave and, you know, what they're up against. And really, for me, was one of the standouts from Sundance from this last year.
Raises some interesting questions about collaboration and who owns this story and this film. And in some ways, I mean, being this refugee, he's not in total control of his story, right?
That's right.
Yeah. And so it's kind of being compiled by somebody else. And so it really works that way.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, thank you for being part of our discussion today and this semester on From the Booth. We have archived both the episodes from the podcast as well as more information about all of these and other films that have played at BYU's International Cinema at the International Cinema website, ic.byu.edu. On the site, you can navigate to past semesters all the way back to 1972 and see what was playing at IC then and what will be playing in the future. From the Booth is produced by the International Cinema Program, who gets its steadfast support from the BYU College of Humanities. We, the host of this podcast, are solely responsible for the opinions and ideas expressed here, as they do not necessarily represent any official position adopted by the university or its supporting institutions. We thank our sound engineer, Joseph Hegstrom Pratt, as well as the staff of the BYU Humanities Resource Center and the Humanities College web team for their support and help as well. We hope you will have a great summer and find us again this fall, both on the podcast, which will start up again in late August, and for the International Cinema Fall 2019 season, which will begin the beginning of the semester in 250 of the Kimball Tower. Take care and have a good summer.
Have a great summer.